From the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners just like you. Please visit stateofbelief.com and help keep this show on the air. Now, here's what's coming up this week.
It's happening in the context of the homophobic legislation.
And it's ignorance, okay? That's where the hatred stems from. The fact that they don't understand the community, they don't know what the reality is, and unfortunately, they have leaders in Russia, Russian politicians, passing laws that make homosexuals second-class citizens.
As the Winter Games got underway in Russia, GQ magazine published a particularly visceral portrait of LGBT life in that country today. In previous books and articles, the author, Jeff Charlotte, has compellingly connected the dots from a conservative evangelical takeover of much of our country's right-wing politics to the wholesale export of the most volatile culture war issues to places like Uganda and now to Putin's Russia, all cloaked in the language of religion and traditional values. Jeff Charlotte is back with us later on this week's show.
Love is a universal emotion. It's something that connects us intimately, and it's something that people of all backgrounds can relate to, regardless of ethnic background, racial background, or faith background.
A couple of years ago, we interviewed one of the editors of the very successful book, Love Inshallah, The Secret Love Lives of American Muslim Women, exploring the complex ways different Muslim women approach faith, love, and relationships. Now, they're following up by offering equal time for the guys. The new book is Salam Love, American Muslim Men on Love, Sex, and Intimacy. And just in time for Valentine's Day weekend, I'll talk with Noura Masnavi. And I've also got a few thoughts I'd like to share about the National Prayer Breakfast and the President's words on religious liberty. Spoiler alert, I did not find them anywhere near as sneer-worthy as much of the far-right echo chamber did. But first,
some U.S. states are enacting their own measures to deal with the reality of an estimated 11 million undocumented people living in the United States.
As the son of immigrants, I think that certainly a lot of people think we should let more people come into our country because it's compassionate for them, and it certainly is. But I think we should also let more people come into our country legally because it's good for us.
In recent weeks, there's been an increasing momentum among legislators on Capitol Hill for immigration reform, most notably on the GOP side of the aisle. Because the changes that 11 million of our friends and neighbors are waiting for won't happen without bipartisan action, we need to see if what we're seeing is real hope for breaking through the gridlock or something else. Jen Smyers works as the Associate Director for Immigration and Refugee Policy with Church World Service. She's at the confluence of strong currents toward reform and toward recognition of the inherent worth of every person. She works for a wonderful organization, and I'm really happy to welcome Jen Smyers to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm glad. How long have you been in this job?
I've been with Church World Service for more than 7 years now.
Well, good for you.
In it to win it.
Well, you're doing this work every day, so I want to start by asking if you also get the sense that we're approaching critical mass on the immigration issue, or is there some kind of drama facade going on?
Well, every day, people of faith witness the real human consequences of our broken immigration system. And it's up to us as people of faith to make sure that we're holding our congressional leaders accountable to real immigration reform that will reunite families and that will provide a path to citizenship for our undocumented community members. We've witnessed our undocumented brothers and sisters afraid to go to church, to go to English class, to go to the grocery store, because they could be ripped apart from their families. Myself, I know a young woman, her name's Jasmine, and when Jasmine was 16 years old, her parents were deported. And she had to really face a decision of how she was going to be raised to grow up without her parents. Fortunately, in her case, her church community stepped in and helped her complete high school. But no child should have to go through what right. Jasmine goes right. through. And that's what happens on a daily basis. Every day that Congress waits to yeah. pass immigration reform, we see this struggle continue. So I think this year is going to be the year, but we have a lot of work ahead of us as people of faith to make that a reality.
What's driving this? I mean, we are seeing a changing situation. What's driving the change?
Well, I think there are a lot of different issues. You can look at elections. You can look at the real continued mobilized energy around immigration reform from the immigrants' rights community, Dreamers, undocumented youth. But in my experience, I see the hearts and minds of Congress members changing because of the actions of people of faith. Literally, pastors, lay leaders, people in the pews are having conversations with their community members, with their members of Congress. They're engaging in prayerful action, fasting for immigration reform, and you're really just seeing this momentum pick up. Actually, there's just a poll out today, a bipartisan poll. 74% of Americans say that they would be disappointed if Congress does not enact immigration reform this year.
I know that among people of faith, we're at the moment for action. But what the question is whether Congress is at that moment. And sometimes it looks like that a lot of Congress is, but a few members could keep the most members from voting. Is that what you see?
That's true. I mean, when we look at public statements that House Republicans have made on immigration reform, we've got 29 House Republicans who have said, I support immigration reform, I support a path to citizenship, but Speaker Boehner is not putting immigration reform up for a vote. We know if we had a vote today, we would win. So there is a need for real deep education with our members of Congress about the urgency for immigration reform and about what immigration reform specifically means, right? Mm-hmm. We don't want any immigration reform. We want immigration reform that will reunite separated families and provide meaningful opportunities for our undocumented community mm-hmm. members to apply for citizenship. And so I really see two courses of action being pivotal this year when we talk about people of faith and prophetic action on immigration reform. The first is increased engagement, the Fast for Families on the Mall. Mm-hmm. Started on the National Mall, 22 days abstaining from all food. Republicans and Democrats alike visited these faith and community leaders, and now they're getting ready to take their message on the road. They're going to be heading out on February 24th. All across the country, starting from the West Coast, going to the East Coast. And they're going to be stopping in 70 congressional districts to demand from those 70 members that they support immigration reform. And I think that's a great way for people to get involved if they're coming to a town near you, or join them in solidarity fasting. They're going to be fasting every Wednesday in Lent specifically. 4 or 5 years ago, when we were praying, having Bible studies on immigration issues, when we were learning about the many biblical characters who are migrants, that was all part of getting us to where we are right now. And so right now, I think there's a number of different things that have to work in tandem. So you have to have the public displays of fasting and personal commitment. You also have to have those personal one-on-one meetings with your members of Congress. So, you know, whether that's a phone call from a pastor, a group of lay leaders who get together as concerned citizens and say, mm-hmm. we want to meet with you. That's one thing that I'm really hopeful about and excited about this year. The Interfaith Immigration Coalition, which we're a proud member, 42 national religious organizations working on immigration reform, have put together a great resource, and it's called the Neighbor to Neighbor Toolkit. And these are local congressional meetings. When our members of Congress are back in their home districts, we can meet with them and say, look, as our member of Congress, you're our neighbor. Our undocumented brothers and sisters are our neighbors, and let's work together and get immigration reform done this year.
What's in that packet? I'm curious.
It's real simple. It's not your typical 20-page toolkit, yeah. eyes glaze over. It's really just 5 pages of why we do neighbor-to-neighbor visits, why it's our duty as people of faith, and there are some scriptural references for our duty to really stand with people who other people might ignore or disdain. Then we go into different talking points, why immigration reform is important. And we also help people put together bit by bit, what does it look like to request a meeting with a member of Congress? What are some of the hoops you might have to jump through, the process that you can go through? And what should a meeting look like? How can you divide up who tells which stories when, so you can do it in a timely way and an effective way? And we also encourage people to work with immigrant rights groups and make sure that someone can be at that meeting who can tell a personal story of how the immigration system has really disrupted their lives. There's also some good points for follow-up with members of Congress and contact information for people like myself and others who work here in D.C. who can follow up with them on this side.
Okay, tell me about the Lenten Fast.
Well, we're proud to be part of the Fast for Families, and it's faith and community groups across the country, and it's happening right smack dab in the middle of the Lenten season. So for us as Christians in particular, we know that Lent is a powerful time where we can reflect, we can give up things, we can commit to things, and what better thing to commit to than immigration reform, to really having a powerful change in the lives of our brothers and sisters who are separated from their families, who are living in fear. So we're challenging everyone. During your Lenten discernment, think about immigrants in your communities. Be part of conversations with other people of faith about how you can really have an impact and meet with your members of Congress. And fast. That can look different for different people in terms of the specifics, fasting from food, fasting from drink, fasting from something else. But join Fast for Families. The website's just fast, the number four, families.org. And you can go and you can see, are people coming? Is the tour bus coming to your town? Show up, say a prayer with them, and then engage. You know, we don't just fast for fasting. We fast for enlightenment, to learn more about ourselves and others. So fast. Talk to a neighbor about why immigration reform is important to you. Make a phone call to your member of Congress. Write a letter to the editor, an opinion editorial to your local paper. People don't think that those things make a difference, but they do. Yes. I've been in congressional offices where staffers are making the marks of who's calling for or against a bill. And when members of Congress know that people of faith in their congressional districts care about immigration reform, are in relationship with immigrants, their hearts and minds change, and so will their vote.
Is there a story that pushed you?
There was. I was in college, and I was in Arizona volunteering, and I knew about immigration. I cared about it from a faith-based perspective generally. But I was driving along a dirt road, and I saw a gentleman on the side of the road who didn't have shoes on, and he had obviously been walking for days. And when we stopped to talk with him, he told us about how his wife and his two young daughters had passed away in the desert. And he had nothing to live for. And it was that moment that it hit me very personally that there's something wrong with our immigration system. When people cannot access legal channels to get here, the desperation that I saw in his eyes are the same types of desperation that I see in the eyes of so many families, women, children, men who are working to make life for their family better. And I think that unless you're in relationship with people who are impacted by the broken immigration system, it can seem like a political issue. It can seem like one more thing to read about or think about. But it's real people. Real lives are impacted. And the policies that we write as the United States literally have life or death consequences for people.
What does keep you going? Some mornings you're bound to wake up and say, is this ever going to happen? What gets you up?
I think a lot, especially in the last year, I've thought a lot about the parable of the persistent widow. And she keeps going to the judge and putting her case in front of him. And he never actually wakes up. He's never actually convinced. But he says, I just want this widow to leave me alone. And so I'm going to grant her petition. I think that's powerful. But I think what really keeps me going is when I go to different congregations across the country and I see pastors and lay leaders who are holding English classes, who are having free legal services for immigrants who can pursue adjustment of status, when I see basic English church services, when I see the work that immigrants and people of faith are doing together, I think, wow, I'm glad to be part of this movement. It's energizing. It's doing God's work. And I'm ready to go. And so I think all of us can be discouraged, but when we're connected with people who are inspirational, who are achieving beyond the struggles that have been put in front of them, it's worth it.
I've been speaking with Jen Smyers, Associate Director for Immigration and Refugee Policy with Church World Service, and I appreciate you being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
My next guest has done outstanding work in exposing the extraordinary influence fundamentalist Christianity has exerted on our national politics with his best-selling books, The Family and C Street. He's done important work examining the links between Western faith leaders and the deadly growth of anti-gay sentiment and laws in Uganda. And now he's written a timely piece for GQ titled Inside the Iron Closet, What It's Like to Be Gay in Putin's Russia, even as the world's eyes are on Sochi for the Winter Games. My guest name is Jeff Charlotte. Jeff, it's always great to have you back with us on State of Belief.
Likewise. Well, and thanks for having me.
If we could begin with you just briefly describing this trip you took, because it seems almost foolhardy what you did to research this report.
Well, I was curious about Russia's new anti-gay laws. So for the magazine GQ, in November, I traveled over there and spent about 2 weeks in Moscow and St. Petersburg. I had originally planned to get out beyond the two big cities, but the situation was so severe, so stark, even in those cosmopolitan centers. I said, look, this is the story right here. And I wanted to talk to the underground LGBT activists who are trying to fight this. I wanted to talk to the people who are deeply closeted, people who are out a few years ago, going back in the closet, and the many, many people who are preparing to essentially go into exile. And I also wanted to talk to the people who were sort of perpetrating this hate, not the politicians. The official story is well documented. I wanted to get some sort of on-the-ground interaction with the men and women who are throwing the stones and the fists and the punches and executing the violence.
Were you comfortable in the conversations?
I certainly wasn't comfortable when I was sitting across from a Cossack who had a gun on me and was telling me to write down his horrible prescriptions of punishments for homosexuals, which he called Cossack humor, at gunpoint. No, I wasn't comfortable then. But there was also, I think, probably a more profound and deeper discomfort in hearing just one heartbreaking story after another. And sometimes stories well told, and then, you know, there's one moment I was in a gay club called Bunker, and there's a man named Yuri, and like many men, this is an attitude I especially found among men, they said, no, we can't fight for our rights anymore. We mustn't fight for our rights. They were terrified. They were broken people. We have to remember that oppression really does oppress. And he says, he says, no more pride parade. He says, I will be beaten. You will be beaten. He will be beaten. We'll be beaten. And we go to the police, and we just smile. And, yeah, that's a profound discomfort. What can you say to such a person?
Is there one particular story, in addition to one you've just told, that really stayed with you and said, stay right here and pursue this?
Yeah, there was two families to the world, two heterosexual families, both professionals, doctors, lawyers, and the manager of the state oil company, and they each had a little daughter, and they're all best friends, and they're lucky enough to have apartments next to one another. The kids go back and forth. They pool their resources and hire a nanny to help take care of the kids, and what nobody knows, not even the nanny, is that the couples are, in fact, two men and two women. And they have these kids together. And I spoke to one of the men who sort of told me the whole story and walked me through it. And he's been so deeply closeted for most of his life, very modest-mannered person, and he just had been pushed to the breaking point. The breaking point for him was teaching his daughter that she can never call him father again, not even at home, because if she slips up just once, she could be taken away from him. And, you know, to me, there's almost sort of, as a parent myself, I can hardly imagine something sort of more perverse, unsettling and dark.
Yeah, I can see why. I was struck by the fear and the uncertainty that the gay Russians admitted to, but also the kind of people you describe as causing much of that fear. It feels like the people brought together around homophobia could easily add other kinds of crimes to their portfolios if they haven't already. It's like Russia's trying to institutionalize hooliganism as much as it's trying to deinstitutionalize modern human rights.
That is exactly, that's the perfect phrase, institutionalizing hooliganism. You know, the way I describe it in the story is that the face of hate in Russia now is like a trinity. It has three faces. The state, the government, is the mind. The Russian Orthodox Church is the heart and the very angry heart of this hate. And then there's what we might in America, or we might even looking over there, dismiss as the fringe, the hooligans. These are the hands. These are the fists. The thing is, you know, there's goons like this. There's thugs. Anywhere you go around the world, the difference is who's standing behind them. So the thug that beats somebody up, the gang like Occupy Pedophilia, they kidnap and torture gay men and then post videos online. They're very visible, and they're not prosecuted, you know. And then on the state TV, there'll be some special declaring gays the enemy within. So this institutionalization of this hooliganism, the way the state sort of winks at it and looks the other way or looks right on, as my friend Yuri said, and smiles. Oftentimes the police have been directly involved in the persecution themselves.
Even with all that's been written about conditions for LGBT people in Russia and you prepared yourself for going, what surprised you the most when you actually got there?
I would say, and this is maybe the hopeful part here, just the steely resolve of some of these activists. And the way you could see it, I think the way it became most evident to me, you know, I talked to so many more people than I could fit in the story. I only met a few people who had not at some point been beaten for being who they were. But this, they never led with that story. Well, and I think if you or I, we'd been to a demonstration and we'd been beaten badly or something, that would become part of our identity. I was the guy who got, you know, knocked down. You can see a famous picture of it. Yeah. It would come up in passing, an hour, 2 hours into the conversation. A joke about a broken nose, a broken jaw, the badge of the gay, as two men describe their broken noses. And they suffer these beatings, and then they go out and they fight for more. There's one woman at the heart of the story, Elena Kostyuchenko. She was arrested again for 20th time this past Friday for singing the national anthem in Red Square during the opening ceremony, and was taken to jail. And apparently, I haven't been able to talk to her, but the account says that she was taken out of her cell. Police took her into a room. They spat on her. They told her she was going to have to perform some sex acts. And she told them what they could do. She's a fearless, fearless person. And she got out. And so what's she going to do? Well, she's planning for the next demonstration. She says, my demands are unnegotiable. They're radical right now. She says, I want to get married to my girlfriend. I want to get a mortgage. I want to have kids. And I'm willing to die to fight for this.
Jeff, one of the enduring gifts that you've given all of us is a comprehensive understanding of the connections between fundamentalism, religious fundamentalism, politics, and money in Washington and across the country. What about the role Western leaders have played in Russia getting it to the point that it has?
What's interesting is now, as you know, having reported on these issues from really around the world, I keep hearing the exact same language. And I mean literally the exact same language, sometimes word for word phrases that come from, as one of the leaders of Narodny Sabor, a big sort of right-wing coalition, in Russia, told me, he says, you know, he says, we got all our statistics for these laws from the websites of American Family Association, Family Research Council. He asked me if I knew these people. Could I introduce him? He was like a fan. And Russia, of course, is a different case than some of these smaller developing nations. American politicians don't carry the weight there. But the ideas, and I think some of us who are more liberal, more on the left, forget that conservative movements understand themselves in part as intellectual movements. They are talking about ideas. They are monstrous ideas at times, but they are ideas. And you really see in Russia how those ideas travel. You see it so clearly that in one interview with a Russian nationalist, a kind of a one-man would-be Pussy Riot of the right, mm-hmm. he calls himself a performance artist, not anything you'd want to see, anti-gay guy, didn't speak English, doesn't like English, but I would hear these English phrases peppering his Russian, family values, traditional values, pro-life. I mean, the very terms were being borrowed from the discourse of American right-wing think tanks, right-wing organizations, and being amplified onto this larger global stage.
So the talk, the vocabulary about traditional Russian values is just convenient rhetoric.
I really think it is. And, you know, I mean, one of the most startling illustrations of this is a bill like this was introduced to the Duma 6 years ago, the Russian parliament. It was laughed out of the parliament. It couldn't even come up for a vote. It was nothing. The deputy prime minister called it a row of mistakes. Russia has homophobia like every other country. And I think that's really important. But this is not some barbaric, backward place. In fact, Russia is a very modern place. LGBT rights have been advancing for a long time. And then there's the discovery that this is a really great political tool. Mm. So Vladimir Putin doesn't care about these issues. What he cares about is the control of his population. He cares about a nationalist rhetoric. And that's when suddenly this bill that goes from getting laughed off the parliament floor, the Duma floor, to this past June passing 436-0. Mm. Not even the gay deputies, and they exist, voted against it.
Where is the Orthodox Church in all of this? Is it an active collaboration or just appreciative support for the anti-gay movement?
It's very strange to hear rhetoric coming from, you know, the highest levels of the Russian Orthodox Church, Patriarch Kirill, the same kind of rhetoric that you might hear from the fringes of the American Christian right in America, from characters like Brian Fisher and so on. Mm-hmm. So the Patriarch Kirill, I mean, they've denounced homosexuality in the absolutely fiercest terms, even as they endorse Vladimir Putin in terms that seem like they're out of the Middle Ages. They call Putin an act of God. It's like, as if they're speaking of the divine right of kings. Mm. You also have to understand about the Russian Orthodox Church. New statistics just came out. Something like 70% of Russians describe themselves as religious Russian Orthodox people. 7% of them go to church. It's a nationalist identity, yeah, far more than it's a spiritual identity.
Gosh. Is there something that should have happened around these games that didn't, that could have helped matters? Is the Olympic Committee and the international community doing all it can?
The Olympic Committee is doing, yeah, it's a famously corrupt organization on any number of fronts, and, you know, this is only the latest. That said, the head of the Olympic Committee, Thomas Bach, who has been no friend to LGBT Russians at all, decided in his speech at the opening ceremony to invoke Olympic Principle 6, which is the principle of equality in sports, mm-hmm. of being equally available to all. This is very much the Olympic spirit. This is not a radical statement. And it is also the sort of the banner of a lot of LGBT activists who are saying, what we're asking for mm-hmm. is Olympic Principle 6. Well, NBC edited that out.
Did they?
They said it was for time. And I'm saying, look, you know, this doesn't matter what your political views on are. Just do your job as journalists. This is a big looming issue in Russia right now. Part of your job is to cover that context. We haven't seen any hesitation on their part to talk about bad hotel rooms, infrastructure problems. We also haven't seen any hesitancy to talk about security issues. Why can't they talk about this real frontline human rights issue? They hear a little bit here and there, but it's been, overall, I'd say, a fairly disgraceful performance.
Yeah.
We have to understand, even though these movements are framed within each country as a nationalist expression, it is part of a global homophobia that is new. It's not just a vestige of an old bigotry. This is right-wing politicians around the planet realizing, hey, we can respond to the economic crises of globalization using this rhetoric. So it's a new and dangerous thing across Eastern Europe, across Africa. India just recriminalized homosexuality. and we need to think, we need to look at it in that global context. Absolutely.
Jeff, Charlotte is a best-selling author and journalist who's written a powerful exposé of what life is like for LGBT persons in today's Russia. It's in the February edition of GQ magazine. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Wilton.
A couple of years ago, I think it was, we introduced you to the work of Aisha Matu and Noura Masnavi. They put together the groundbreaking book titled Love Inshallah, The Secret Love Lives of American Muslim Women. The book contained surprising, honest, and very moving first-person stories. Now, Aisha and Noura are back with a follow-up titled Salam, Love, American Muslim Men on Love, Sex, and Intimacy. And just in time for Valentine's Day weekend, Noura Masnavi back again on State of Belief Radio. Noura, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Noura, I know that you were convinced the other book, the book on women, was important. Were you surprised at how important it was?
I think with the first book, it really came out of a place where Aisha and myself saw a gap, gap in the types of stories that people were seeing about Muslim women. And so we really wanted to address that gap. We really wanted to fill it with stories that reflected our lives and the lives of the women who we know.
Yeah.
And I think the same is true for men, and not just Muslim men. I think men in general, you know, we talk a little bit about it in our introduction that men have incredible power and leadership, but we don't often hear men talking about love and intimacy.
Yeah.
And I think that that's because, unfortunately, there's sort of these notions of masculinity and the way in which young men are sort of taught often to maybe hide emotions or not express themselves. And so we thought, what if men did have the space to be vulnerable, to share? What would happen? And we are so pleased by what did happen in this particular case.
Talk about a couple of the men you included in this book that really left an impression on the two of you.
I think one of the most moving sections in the collection for me is the last section. It's called Sabr in Sickness and Health. And Sabr is the Arabic word for patience and perseverance. And in that section, we have stories by men who either are suffering from their own physical or mental health issue, or they're caring for a partner with a health issue. And so two stories that I think in that section really moved me. One was a story by Alan Howard, who was married for 18 years to a woman who had cancer. And for about 8 years, he was her primary caregiver before she passed. And I think often when we think of stories of a spouse caring for a terminally ill spouse, we often think of women as caregivers. So this story was a really interesting insight into what a man goes through when he's caring for a loved one with a terminal illness. That's an incredibly moving, very touching story. Everybody cries when they read it. Another story that I think is really important in the collection is by our writer, Khizr Hussein, who writes about his wife's infertility diagnosis. And again, I think particularly within the Muslim community, I think it's a really important story for men to read. What happens when you're in a community where a lot of people, you know, Khizr is South Asian, and particularly within the South Asian Muslim community, there's incredible pressure to have children right after a couple is married. So what happens in the case that you're unable to conceive? How does a couple deal with that within their relationship, but also within the context of a greater community? And his story is incredibly honest and very moving as well.
Noura, did you come across any gay or bisexual men who were willing to contribute?
Yes, we have two contributors who write about their experiences, both touch on their coming out stories. Mm-hmm. And I think what was really interesting about these two stories is both men really talk about coming back to the faith, that the period around their coming out was incredibly painful, with family dynamics being strained, and it also really tests their faith and their relationship with God. And so the pieces are really a beautiful illustration of the journey that we often take within our faith. It's not a straight path, but we can often come back to God mm-hmm. through a particular incident, and that's what both of those two stories really illustrate quite beautifully.
What was most surprising about what you saw?
All of the men in the book seem to be longing and searching for partnership and a long-term committed relationship. We often think of men sort of commitment phobes, shying away from real responsibility in a relationship, but that wasn't the case for any of our writers. There really is a search for a long-term partnership and the love of their lives, and that was really surprising to me.
What myths or stereotypes do you think the stories in this book shatter?
That's a great question. I think when we hear about Muslim men, there are so many stereotypes that come to mind: angry and misogynistic and just gruff. And mm-hmm. we don't associate with Muslim men feelings of love or sensitivity. And I think when you read this collection, one thing that strikes me is how vulnerable the men are and how they are so open and honest about what they're feeling, what they're going through, the pain, so much, you know, insecurity. And I think it will really shatter this sort of almost this mythical creation that we've created about the Muslim man, and really portray men as they are, which is incredibly diverse and nuanced mm-hmm. and complex.
Is this a book about this one and the one on women? Are these books about American Muslims, and how different would it be if you were writing about Muslims in the Middle East in the same way?
That's an interesting question. I think, Aisha and I really limited these books to American Muslims because both of us were born and raised here in mm-hmm. the United States. Mm-hmm. And so we understand the cultural context of the people contributing.
Sure. Yeah.
And so we thought, you know, if this was a collection of Muslims in the United Kingdom or Malaysia, for example, their cultural context is very different.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
I do think that there would be similar themes, you know, the themes mm-hmm. of that are universal to all people, regardless of background or faith, this sort of universal search for partnership and for love and hope, vulnerability. I think those are universal themes. But I think if we were to see this collection in different countries, I do think it would be different
sure.
with respect to different cultural contexts.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of our dreams, is to see this collection picked up
good.
In other countries and having local writers and local editors bringing these stories to life.
My guess is there would be some people who would want to read both books because they are trying better to understand Muslims, and that's a good thing. And so my sense was they're going to see, I think in a surprising way, a lot of commonality between men and women, Muslim, Christian, Jew, whatever, in this environment that may not be true in another environment, but is very, very helpful.
You know, and the other thing is that the Muslims are in the book, as you no doubt realized as you read the book, is that even within the Muslim community, there's such incredible diversity
right.
of racial, ethnic background, even religious practice. So that's another thing that people from all over can connect to somebody in the book. There's somebody who perhaps is raised in a similar environment or had a similar family dynamic or practice in a particular way.
I need a really quick answer, short answer on this one, but what has this project done to you and Aisha?
I think it has really renewed our faith and excitement about the Muslim community. It's so rare, not even in the Muslim community, I think in any faith community, to have different segments of a faith community really interact with one another. And, you know, if you have people who practice traditionally or are more secular, it's rare to find venues or outlets for all segments of the community to interact. And mm-hmm. For us, this has been one of the most rewarding things about this process, is that we've brought together writers, and the writers have really developed an incredible sisterhood and brotherhood in a way that I don't know if that would have happened without these collections.
Yeah. I've been speaking with Noura Masnavi. She and Aisha Matu put together the groundbreaking book, Salaam, Love, American Muslim Men on Love, Sex, and Intimacy. Like their previous book of stories of Muslim women, this is a collection of personal vignettes of a diverse range of Muslim men, and it is a fascinating collection, as was their prior book. So, Noura, and I hope you'll say this to Aisha as well, happy Valentine's Day weekend.
Thanks
for involving State of Belief Radio in your lives so that we and our listeners could find out more about a community that we appreciate and respect, and about those views on love.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Before we go, a few words I want to share. From the first moment State of Belief went on the air to this moment on the air, State of Belief has examined carefully the role of sectarian bodies in secular politics. The issue is always controversial, even as it is always important. Last week on this show, Catherine Henderson, president of Auburn Seminary, suggested that the solution for sectarian meddling in secular politics is not always just working to protect religion from political infiltration and vice versa, that in fact, since it's likely that we'll continue to see some religious factions bring their religious beliefs to the ballot box, it's equally important to work toward greater representation of all such voices in the public square. Now, I want to say a good word about President Obama in this context. Right after the President's State of the Union address, I shared with you some critical thoughts about what I considered the glaring absence of any mention of religious freedom, an issue that's been appearing often in our public rhetoric and courtrooms, and there was no reference to it in the President's address. This past week at the National Prayer Breakfast, Barack Obama focused on religious freedom. The prayer breakfast itself raises its own set of concerns, especially when a rather narrowly sectarian portion of Congress and the media eagerly lay claim to the event and the language used to describe it. Thanks to that, though, we have the odd paradox of the leader of the free world, a Christian like them, be regarded at the prayer breakfast almost as an interloper at their event. However, even as a lot of commentary suggested, that Obama's support for access to health care and reproductive choice clashed with his concern for religious freedom, I'd like to argue just the opposite and suggest a greater role for progressive people of faith and of no faith in the national dialogue. Neither fundamentalists nor conservatives own any religion. Organizations like Interfaith Alliance emerged when people like Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson audaciously tried to claim that they represented all people of faith in the United States. Well, that wasn't true then, and that's not true now. People who listen to this show have important ideas and principles that need to be voiced in all national conversations. I'm inviting you to the table. I realize that an event like the National Prayer Breakfast is inherently a turnoff for many progressive people of faith and people of no faith, but simply ignoring it does nothing but cede the event to those who would claim it. And that's why I think the president's words hold importance even beyond their content. He spoke articulately on what I consider to be a very important subject indeed. But more than that, he did so to an audience that contained a number of leaders who've been working aggressively to redefine or weaken religious freedom and to subvert for their own political goods that language. What a good model the president gave all of us to follow. State of Belief has aired on stations in which my commentaries were bracketed between Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity. I love it when that happens, because people who listen to those two might accidentally hear words from State of Belief. And those are the people who need our message most. Those are people whom we need to engage. The president had no fear in sharing the truth about the importance of religious freedom among people who seldom hear the constitutional definition of religious freedom. Good for him. And good for us when we do the same. We often talk about needing money to get on more radio stations. I love it when we're right in the middle of the schedule of a right-wing radio station. That's where we need to be, even with all of the criticism, just as we need to be with you and take strength from your affirmation. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. We can only produce this show with the generous support of listeners like you. Please visit stateofbelief.com and consider making a contribution today. We'll use it wisely to keep the State of Belief program on the air and to expand the reach of the program at a time when so few voices representing an inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue seem to exist. Stateofbelief.com is where you can find out more about the show. Hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. You'll find more information about the topics discussed on this week's show and resources to help bring State of Belief to a radio station near you. Please stay in touch with us throughout the week. You can do that on Facebook and Twitter. There's also contact information available at stateofbelief.com. The listener line is 202-681-4246. We encourage you, as always, to tell other people about the show and encourage them to listen so that we can broaden the base of the conversation that needs to go on in our nation. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. I'll be in Iowa next week, but we will be with you from there. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, he was.